Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media. I'm David McDougall, long-time listener, first-time caller, and I'll be holding the reins of this horse and buggy as we canter through some of the biggest stories this week in Scottish politics. Joining the conversation, we've got my colleagues from the politics team, North to South, Leslie Ann Kelly in Dundee, Callum Ross in Edinburgh, and Dan O'Donoghue in Westminster. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
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 We could just jump right in with Callum first. And a story that broke, as stories seem to do, just as we were all thinking about turning off the computers and maybe putting a socially distanced ready meal for one in the microwave on Thursday evening, the resignation of Scottish Labour leader Richard Leonard. Now, Callum, did this come out of the blue or were we expecting it? How did it all go down?
I mean, I don't think it will have come as a surprise to anyone that Richard Leonard tenure as Scottish Labour leader has come to an end. In some ways, it's a bit of a miracle he's survived as long as he has in the job. But what was surprising, I suppose, was the timing, given we're just 4 months away from an election. And, you know, he was very adamant that he was the right person to lead the party into the election when he faced a rebellion from inside and outside his party last September. So, yeah, I mean, I think the time was a bit surprising. There's been a lot of speculation about why he's decided to go now. Talk of intervention from Keir Starmer, the UK party leader. Possible input from donors, the trade unions. Mr. Leonard's obviously a lifelong trade unionist, so that might have had an effect on him. And possibly also he just realised that you know, he was going to have to go after the election anyway. They were facing yet another humiliating defeat. So why put himself through that and give his opponents, you know, the satisfaction of seeing him go through that? So maybe that came into it as well. But who knows?
Well, let's go back to the timing, because he faced the coup attempt last autumn. And he hung on and nothing really came of it. Then he says that he's been considering his position over Christmas. So if you consider your position over Christmas, why do you wait until, you know, the third week of January to decide that you're going? If he'd already decided that he didn't want to hang on, it seems like he hung on. He then went on to, you know, hang on a bit longer. It just seemed odd timing, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, to be honest, he's been kind of hanging on since the day he got the job. It's felt a bit like that. He got off to a bad start when his victory was kind of overshadowed by Kezia Dugdale going into "I'm a celebrity, get me out of here," and you know, it never really got much better, to be honest. I think you're right, the timing is odd. Something's obviously gone on in the background. In his statement, he kind of linked it to the pandemic, and that he'd kind of reflected on whether the constant speculation about if his own future was getting in the way of Labour's ability to, you know, make its case for what should be done in terms of the response to the pandemic. But 4 months before an election, it feels a bit odd, doesn't it?
Do you think that he imagines that with him gone, Labour will suddenly be challenging the SNP and the Tories to be the dominant party in Scotland? I mean, that would seem a little bit far-fetched.
No, I don't think he thinks that, for sure. I don't think he thinks that. I don't think most people think that. I mean, there was a kind of gleeful response from some in Labour online yesterday on social media, but, you know, anyone who thinks the departure of Richard Leonard is going to solve all the party's problems is fairly deluded, to be honest. They were on a downward trajectory long before he became leader, and there's no obvious big name successor waiting in the wings to swoop in and revive them. At the end of the day, Labour has a fundamental problem in Scotland in that they're a left of centre party in a country, left of centre unionist party in a country where most left of centre voters are now supporting independence. There are not many votes for them to go for, and whichever way they turn, by becoming softer or harder on the independence issue, risks them losing more ground to either the SNP or the Tories. So it's an existential problem in a way, and whoever kind of replaces him has got a big job in his hands.
Well, you've been looking at some of those runners and riders today who might be replacing him, and There are, I think, some obvious candidates who, his challenger last time, for example, they could keep the deputy leader of the party in Scotland in an interim basis, or it could be somebody from out of the blue. I saw my old local MP, Gordon Brown's name thrown in again, which is probably the kind of name people like to throw in every time there's a Labour leadership contest in Scotland. But who's on your radar?
Yeah,
speculate they might do.
I've seen those names as well. Gordon Brown would certainly be an interesting choice. I'm not sure.
Fife's finest.
I'm not sure how Keir Starmer would feel about that. It would be an interesting dynamic. Yeah, I mean, the same names, Anna Sarwar, obviously, who you mentioned, who Richard Leonard defeated for the leadership. I mean, he was once considered the great hope of the party. He was going to revive them, but it never really happened for him to date, but you never know. Jackie Bailey's obviously the deputy leader. My understanding is she's stepping in on an interim basis, so perhaps there's always the option that she could take them into the election, and then they could have a proper debate, discussion about the future direction of the party after the election, and also see who they get in, because there might be some talented new faces come in after the election. We featured some of them in our Generation Next series a few months ago. The likes of Barry Black are standing, and John Erskine, who are considered rising stars, although they might think it's a bit early for a leadership challenge. Then there's the likes of kind of possibly more on the left of the party. Kind of Monica Lennon's been quite impressive in recent years. She's got some interesting things to say, I think. So it's all to play for, I think, at this stage. We'll see over the next few days and weeks who kind of rules themselves in and out. But they obviously need to make a decision one way or another about what they're going to do fairly quickly, because there's an election on the horizon.
But it's a bit of a poison chalice if somebody was to take over now. And even Jackie Bailey taking over on an interim basis, it's a poison chalice, because they're not going to miraculously do well at the Holyrood elections in the spring. And so, you know, it's a thankless task to be the party leader now, even on an interim basis. Who would want to do that? I can't imagine, you know, anyone's champing at the bit for it.
It's difficult to imagine there being a big upturn in their fortunes in 4 months, given the way it's been going. But, you know, who knows? You never know in politics these days what's going to happen. But yeah, you're right. It's if a new leader takes over just now, even if they're unimposed, they're probably going to get off to a bad start with the election. They'll be given some leeway because they haven't had the time. But, you know, it's still a bad start. And it's not how they would want it to go, I would think. So I do wonder. I mean, I do wonder if the kind of interim basis is the way they might go and get through that election, and then have a big discussion, you know, finally come to a conclusion about what direction they want to go after that.
And then one question: if they're looking to the future and maybe having that discussion about the party and the state of the party in Scotland after the elections. And as you said, most of the centre-left voters in Scotland are pro-independence. Is there any possibility that Scottish Labour will conclude, if we want to get those voters, we also need to be pro-independence?
I think it's unlikely they would become pro-independence. I think there are people in the party, probably still a minority, but there are people who would like a kind of softer stance on whether there should be a second referendum. To try and, you know, tempt back some former voters who maybe left to join the SNP or to vote for the SNP because of the independence issue. But I do think they're in the minority. I think certainly among the MSP group, and from the ones I'm aware of, some of the ones standing next in May, their views certainly that Labour should continue to be a unionist party. Basically, the independence issue is the main issue in town, and you've got to have a position. And while it's not the issue Labour probably would want to be focusing on, they feel that they have to have a clear position, and one of the problems with Richard Leonard, not helped by Jeremy Corbyn and his allies, has been that Labour's position on independence in the second referendum hasn't always been clear in recent years. So I think whoever is the leader will want to have a very clear position on what their stance is.
Well, you mentioned Jeremy Corbyn. Maybe this is a good moment to loop in Dan in Westminster, because at the last time there was an election for a Scottish Labour Party leader, and with Richard Leonard getting this role, he was very much a friend of Jeremy's. And I wonder, Dan, if that plays into anything now with who the new leader could be. Do they have to be a friend of Keir's, or is it maybe not quite so factional now as it was then with Corbyn in charge?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, you know, Richard was very much seen as the kind of Corbynista candidate, and, you know, he's always been a very long-term friend of Jeremy Corbyn. And I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, when Corbyn, you know, eventually went down here and we had that leadership race, there was a move in the party away from that wing of politics. You know, if you looked at kind of Rebecca Long Bailey, who was seen very much as the continuity Corbyn candidate, you know, she just kind of fell by the wayside in that election. I think a lot of people in the Labour Party, you know, while big fans of Jeremy Corbyn, perhaps, were also not very big fans of not winning elections. You know, there may be a similar move in the Scottish Party now to, you know, try and go for someone who's a bit more electable. But as Callum's outlined, you know, it's very difficult for the party, whoever it is, you know, because they are facing such an existential crisis at the minute, you know, whatever candidate it is. It's not really a question, I suppose, of the person. It's more kind of the policy, and until they've kind of truly worked out what they stand for in Scottish politics, it's going to be quite a rough ride for them.
Well, bringing Callum in again, if we look at Scottish politics, it's very much about personality over policies when it comes to some of the other parties, whether you've got Ruth Davidson or Douglas Ross or Nicola Sturgeon. So in this case, do they need a big hitter? Because we've talked before, I've had to write down the words Richard Leonard on a piece of paper because I forget his name, because he's forgettable. And Callum, your piece called him the invisible man yesterday. Your analysis on this called him the invisible man. So although there is a focus on policies, is it also a balance to be found for personality, which plays so importantly in Scotland?
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. And we were saying earlier, weren't we, that it was quite telling that a lot of people's immediate reaction to the story has been, who are you talking about? It didn't even make the front pages of some of the papers today, which is quite something for the resignation of a Scottish Labour leader, and kind of shows the scale of its decline. Yeah, I think while Scottish Labour has existential issues to resolve, certainly a bigger name who the public are aware of and might start to listen to certainly can't do any harm. It's just who that person is. You know, there's a shortage of big hitters on the Labour benches at the moment. So, you know, it's not clear where that person is going to come from, but absolutely that is what they need as a starting point, at least.
And that's why I think there's still hope for the man from Kirkcaldy. I'm just going to keep throwing it out there for Gordon Brown. Thank you, both of you, for that discussion. Let's change gears now and look at the coronavirus pandemic. And as Scotland continues with another lockdown amid tighter restrictions, there's glimmers of hope on the horizon with regard to virus levels and another really important metric, the number of people getting vaccines. Leslie Ann Kelly in Dundee, that's your particular area of expertise. Not giving people jags, but tracking the vaccines. And we've come to an important moment this week when the Scottish Government has started to release more figures and more details. What's been happening around that?
There's been pressure on the Scottish Government to start releasing daily figures for a while now. If you tuned into any of the daily briefings last week, you might have seen journalists pressing the First Minister to release this information. And there was a bit of a reluctance on her part. There was kind of citing resource issues. Well, if they're starting to focus on that, then Public Health Scotland being the they, if they start to focus on that, then there's other things that they need to be doing to do with, you know, other COVID-19 data and just, you know, other public health data that they need to be dealing with. But I think she kind of, there was definitely a point this week, and I think that point may have been when Prime Minister Boris Johnson said that they would start providing the English day by day, jab by jab data that she then had to start making it a priority.
Yeah, there's nothing quite so motivating as, no. as trying to keep up with the neighbours, I suppose.
Absolutely. So where we've been with the data in the past is before Christmas, we Public Health Scotland were releasing really basic top line. This is the amount of people that have had the first dose in the last week. And that is all we were getting up until Monday when we started getting more information day by day. And then on Wednesday, the 13th, we started, Public Health Scotland added to their weekly release to start including new demographic data, which is great. It's what people have been asking for. So we can now see how many people have been vaccinated in each health ward, which I think in Scotland, with our particular kind of ruralities, seeing if there are any issues in getting the doses to, I think particularly most of the doses up until now have been the Pfizer vaccine that needs to be stored at minus 70 degrees. So it's definitely very good for accountability to see if people in the kind of Highlands and Islands are getting their share of the doses, which it's definitely looking quite promising for now. But as well as that, we're seeing data by sex and age group. So we're seeing if the what's happening in the JCVI priority groups of people that need to be vaccinated first. And we're getting data by eligibility criteria. So is the person being vaccinated because they're a healthcare worker or a care home resident? We're getting that kind of thing. What we're seeing in that is that right now the vaccination doses are swinging towards women, which is understandable based on the demographics of people that are being vaccinated right now, given our care home resident population swings towards women, our healthcare worker population swings towards women. So that makes sense for now.
And from when you mentioned about accountability and transparency, this is important, not just from a data perspective, but from a more traditional journalism perspective, to hold the government accountable mm-hmm. and local health boards accountable when they say, we're going to start the rollout with this group, we're going to target these groups. And, you know, they've set out some very clear milestones and priorities. And having access to this data means that we journalists can then hold them to account to make sure that they're on track with what they say they're going to be doing, and not just making empty promises. You know, we've seen other governments with making moonshot promises. Mm-hmm. I think in America, Joe Biden says 100 million vaccines in 100 days, which is an incredible amount of vaccines. I know it's not quite the scale of that in Scotland.
No, but we are.
We can see how we're doing. So tell us. I know you've been looking at that compared with the other nations.
We are starting to see some of those kind of crazy targets being thrown out there. Jean Freeman said she wanted to have the over 80s and care home populations, etc., vaccinated by February, and she said that was around 560,000 people. I mean, you look at the vaccination program started in the middle of December, and yeah, there was a bit of a kind of. Everything kind of shuts down in Scotland for Christmas, as we know. So there was a bit of a die down in the daily figure or the weekly figures over the festive period. But we started the vaccination programme mid-December. And as of yesterday, the latest figure that we have for first doses of vaccinations provided is 208,000. So we're 15th of January just now as we're recording this. And Jean Freeman is saying that she wants 560,000 people vaccinated by February. If we don't start seeing massive increases in the amounts provided every day, that's going to be some tall order.
I know that we reported this week that the rate the vaccinations were going, the Scottish government couldn't even meet the Scottish government's targets.
Mm-hmm.
So, but now we're seeing some announcements of vaccination centres opening up at P&J Live in Aberdeen, for example, where they're going to be doing these mass testings, I think, as they get further on with the programme. So that at least allows them the capacity to roll out more tests, more people, get more people through, not necessarily for, you know, from care homes or frontline workers, but when they start moving, you know, that line to the under 50s, which all of us are qualified for on the Stooshie today, I think. Some closer to that line than others, I will admit. But, you know, those mass vaccination centres, as we've seen in other countries, Israel's been very effective with it as well, at mobilising the population like that and these mass centres. It will start to push the I was going to say push the needle, but that's one inoculation pun too many.
Push the jag.
It will push the jag on the number of people. The other thing is that from what you do, this is still very keenly sought after information on the DC Thompson websites, on the news websites. People are very keen to see the coronavirus rates and the vaccination rates. It's still something that people go to and one of our most viewed stories on the politics site. What are the other metrics, some of the other metrics looking like in terms of coronavirus cases or hospitalization?
I mean, as well as the vaccination program, like you say, there are small little bits of hope in the other data. For example, with the cases, since our expected surge after Christmas and household mixing, etc., the average number of cases is starting to slowly come down. I think Jason Leach has said that it's coming down, but it's starting to plateau, and that is kind of what I'm seeing as well. It's coming down, but very, very, very slowly. So it's not coming down quite enough as they would like it to. The positivity rate is coming down as well. Like yesterday, for example, it was 8.3% positive cases out of the total people tested. And last week, at various points, that was over 15%. So whilst it's still above the World Health Organization line of 5% for your pandemic being under control or not, it definitely is starting to come down. The one thing that isn't quite coming down yet, or there's a few things. Obviously, you have cases, they present first, and then hospitalizations present a few weeks after that, and then deaths present a few weeks after that. So we are still going to see kind of high numbers of hospitalizations and deaths for a while. It's probably, with hospitalizations in particular, we're seeing various health boards, quite a few health boards have already breached the capacity that they had set for COVID cases. NHS Tayside in my area is teetering on the brink of beds that they have available for COVID patients. Every day I look at those figures with kind of a sense of horror, and then the line just keeps going up in practically a straight line fashion. So whilst there are areas of hope, there's definitely still areas of concern for the data that we would really like to start see coming down soon.
Leslie Ann, thanks. And if you hear noises in the background, it's my overweight Labrador snoring right next to the desk. It's no reflection on the information you're giving us, but just in case the other Stooshy listeners wonder what the noise in the background is, it's a fat Labrador snoring. Leslie Ann, thanks very much for your input. And from dry land, we're heading 20,000 leagues under the sea, where Brexit and fishing continues to be the rocks on which politicians are dashing themselves. Dan O'Donoghue is back again in Westminster. You've been following it this week as it continues. Give us the recap here. What's the week in fishing been like, Dan?
Well, an absolute nightmare and a disaster, according to a lot of those in the industry. I mean, we've seen many more stories of kind of firms being unable to export catch. The industry is now basically reported to be suffering losses of around more than £1 million a day. You know, we're told that this is down to IT problems and issues with customs declarations, but it's got, you know, to such a point now where, you know, even fishermen out at sea are being told to kind of stop returning catch. Unsurprisingly, you know, opposition politicians have been queuing up to have a pop at the government over this, asking Boris Johnson, you know, where the Brexit sea of opportunity is. The government's response has not really been helped by a series of embarrassing gaffes this week, not least from the fisheries minister, Victoria Prentice, who made a rather embarrassing admission to the House of Lords committee. I think we can actually hear a section of that now.
So, Minister, I suppose my question is, did your jaw drop as well when you saw this agreement that had been delivered in fisheries, when really this is, was such an iconic subject?
No, the agreement came when we were all very busy on Christmas Eve, in my case, organising the local nativity trail. We've been waiting.
Dan, I've listened to that clip several times, several many times, and, you know, I still can't even with it. Even if you were the Minister for Fisheries and you didn't have time to read it, don't you just lie about it? I mean, don't say that you're too busy with something else. Just say that, yes, absolutely, I read it all. I mean, but...
Well, yeah, I mean, I can only imagine what her aides and press officers must have thought. It's kind of a thick of a hands in head moment, you know. Why would you say that, you know, when firms are kind of backs against the wall, they've had a terrible couple of weeks. It's just don't say that, you know. But I mean, that wasn't the only gaffe in the set. It was a pretty tough session for her, really. I mean, she also kind of spoke about how an answer to some of these export woes was British people eating more fish, which, you know, again, it's not really a solution that you know, is doable now and fishermen want to hear, really. But as I say, I mean, that really is kind of one of only a couple this week. We've also had Jacob Rees-Mogg dismissing concerns, saying that, you know, fish are happier now because they're British. And, you know, David Dukit, who is a local MP to P&J Readers, he's also a junior minister in the Scotland office. He was asked how long some of these delays might go on for. And he came back and said, you know, how long is a piece of string? So it's just been one thing after another, really. I mean, we had Boris Johnson this week was before the liaison committee, which is basically a chance for a bunch of senior MPs to kind of put a series of questions to the Prime Minister for a couple of hours. And, you know, in that meeting, this was raised, the plight of the Scottish seafood sector. And he, in his typical kind of Boris Johnson way, kind of mumbled and muttered and eventually said something to the effect of, we will ensure that the industry is compensated. But since then, you know, there's been no further detail about a compensation scheme for Scottish fishers. And, you know, the Environment Secretary, George Eustace, was asked repeatedly about this the other day. And he kind of was asked, I think it was seven times he was asked, and he kind of ducked the question seven times. So it doesn't even sound like there's any compensation forthcoming. So it's been a bit of a nightmare week, really, I think, for the industry.
Let's take a step back and roll back the curtain for the listeners on how the Victoria Apprentice or any of these moments come about. This isn't them standing up in Parliament necessarily or doing a live TV interview and having a gaffe. These are committee meetings where they're talking for several hours and you know, perhaps just forget that journalists like you are watching. How does it work then?
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, so basically every day in Parliament, there's an order paper. And on that order paper, it will kind of tell you what's going on in the Commons, what's going on in the Lords. And then, as you say, there's kind of a dozen or more committee hearings. Now, these could be on anything. I mean, some of them are quite general, you know, general inquiries on, you know, the impact of Brexit generally, or, you know, very, very detailed hearings on, you know, what a certain, you know, section of a certain law would impact one section of an industry. And basically, you know, it's difficult sometimes to read which ones might be interesting and which ones won't be. And, you know, for our readers, fishing is a massive issue, especially after Brexit. So anything to do with that, really, I always keep an eye out for. And, you know, this was before a Lords committee, which generally aren't very well watched because, as I say, Lords committees tend to be a lot more detailed. They're less about, you know, you'll often find in House of Commons committees, there's a lot of grandstanding because, you know, a lot of MPs want their moment, you know, on the TV, whether it's a clip or something of them kind of having a go at the Prime Minister. But the Lords tend to be less bothered about that kind of stuff. So they kind of ask very forensic questions and sometimes it can be quite boring. So this, as I say, this came during a Brexit subcommittee meeting, and it was about an hour and a half into an evidence session that this comment came from Victoria Apprentice. And as I say, you know, it's obviously a bit of an unfortunate gaffe, but it's come at a time when, you know, the industry is really suffering and really hurting, really. And it just should have been, you know, the minister should have been a bit more guarded, I think, with her words.
And when it comes to the Brexit agreement, the future trade agreement, fisheries has been at the centre of the controversy around it, about the deal that the British and especially Scottish fishermen are getting, especially when we think about how important the fisheries industry is in Scotland. And yet, with gaffe after gaffe, in other governments, I would have expected a resignation by now. But it looks like they're just going to front it out. Is that?
I think, you know, if we look back over kind of Boris Johnson's administration so far, there's not been many resignations, really. I mean, you know, your mind jumps to things like, you know, the Dominic Cummins scandal, where it was kind of, it felt like it was a very kind of cut and shut case where, you know, COVID restrictions have been breached and he should have just resigned. You know, there's been other instances as well, and it just seems that the temptation of the government is often just try and tough these things out, and You know, there's always another story on the horizon that'll move the debate on, and things like this will be forgotten about. But I certainly don't think that you know, fishing communities who would have seen that video would forget very quickly what was said this week.
No, and it was one of the top stories, you know, on the Evening Express website and on social media when that story broke. So that was a great get this week, a nice exclusive. So we salute you for your services to journalism, for watching all those committee meetings. Another thankless task for watching those. Thanks very much, Dan. Well, that's all from the Stooshie this week. Thanks to Leslie Ann Kelly, Callum Ross and Dan O'Donoghue, and Chris Finn, who's engineering the whole episode. Don't forget to listen, download or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and join us again next week. Bye for now.
The Stooshie is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you are better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph and The Evening Express work hard every day, online and in print, to bring you careful reporting and analysis to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, Westminster and beyond. Subscribe to The Stooshie today, recommend us to friends and family, rate and review it if you have a moment, and let us know what you think of what we cover and how we cover it on Twitter and Facebook. We're Stooshie Scott on both. Be better briefed with The Stooshie from DC Thompson Media.